You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group, www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Editor-in-Chief Rob Weinert-Kent. I'm here with...
Deep Tran, Associate Editor.
And Susie Evans, Senior Editor.
We've got quite a show for you today. We have three things. We're going to talk about our February issue, some of which is online, as particularly a package about compensation in the theater, curated by Deep Tram. We'll have lots of things to say about it. We'll also talk about what I would call rumors and reports last week that the new presidential administration, which we're also excited about, has plans to cut the NEA and the NEH, privatized corporation public broadcasting, a whole budget blueprint which was purportedly leaked. We need to talk about that a little bit as best we can. Then we have an interview with Robert Barry Fleming.
Yeah, the new associate artistic director at Cleveland Playhouse.
Who was in town, and we talked to him. Susie talked to him.
I did, yes. Ironically, I met him at our Cleveland conference, so it was kind of a full circle chat.
So we'll do some of our chatter. We'll go to the interview and then do recommendations. So Deep, you curated what was initially planned to sort of in a vague way, but at least in my mind, as a money issue. And then it was clear, you know what? Let's talk about compensation specifically. Now, there's lots of money things in the theater to talk about, fundraising, you know, all kinds of money stuff. But when we talk about money, we're talking about money, people getting paid. So tell me about the stories in this issue and how they came together.
I've always been really fascinated just by how artists make a living in the theater, because I feel like it's one of those things that's very taboo, but the common knowledge is you don't make money in the theater. But then I see people who do, and that makes me wonder, if the common knowledge is everyone's poor, then how can, for example, people have kids, or how can they afford to work for free when they're younger, and where does the money come from in order to finance our lifestyles? So just the nuts and bolts of being an artist. Anecdotally, one of the reasons I did not want to be like a professional writer was because I knew, you do not get paid to be an artist. And so the past couple of years, I've been really fascinated by how artists make a living. And so I wrote a piece a few years ago about how artists are handling their student loan debt.
All right.
And then a piece about how playwrights are paid because royalties is not enough to actually subsidize a living playwright's life. And then last year, I did the piece about the overtime laws and what theaters are doing to, budget for higher salaries within their fundraising. So it's been an ongoing, little mini beat that I've been fascinated with. And mm-hmm. So when it came time to have the opportunity to do something a little bit bigger, I kind of jumped at that. And also... And it was also the most fascinating thing money-wise for me. And so for this issue in particular, I decided to look at it from three different ways. The first one was looking institutionally at what theaters are doing to pay artists and admin above the minimum, or raise their admin, the salaries of their administrative people, especially now that the overtime rules is no longer taking effect. And then looking at just asking I asked six artists exactly how many jobs they have to take a year in order to put together a living wage.
So five artists and one admin person.
Artists and one admin, to compare. And the results were interesting.
What was the max salary we're talking about? Well, someone was made triple digits, but
someone made triple digits.
Ten different jobs.
Yeah, a director made. Not so much 10 different jobs. That person worked five jobs, theater directing jobs, and then they also got an award, and then they also Airbnb'd their apartment.
Okay, yeah, I don't remember. And then the lowest was like 30,000 or something, or something like that, I forget.
Yeah, like 28,000.
And we had some figures about what the average cost of living there is. Anyway, it's a fascinating, they told us pretty much you know, opened up their books. Some of them even told us their names.
Yeah.
Others wanted to be anonymous. And then we also had a piece by Leina Nanaka Winkler, who was a guest on the last podcast about a totally different topic.
Well, she and I were having happy hour one day, and then she said, "Hey, I pitched this piece to the Times, and I don't really know if they respond to me." And I asked her what it was, and she said, "Well, I'm from, you know, Lexington, Connecticut. I grew up really poor, and I had to sell my eggs in order to come to New York City, and so I wanted to write a piece about like income inequality within artists, and how when you're poor and you don't have family money to help you pay your rent, like, how do you become an artist, especially when it's common knowledge that if you're just starting out, you'll be expected to work for free."
No, it's a really incisive piece because it's written in very much the first person with their own experience, but then talking almost as if she brought in a bunch of other people to help write it, but like other voices. It's interesting the way she wrote the piece, and a lot of, you know, just not just good anecdotes, but sort of a good argument emerges in there about, it's a little bit of, you know, buck up and stay with it argument, but with a lot more grit to it than the usual, just, it'll all work out. You know, it's really not a Pollyanna piece.
What I've been really loving about doing this coverage is like people are actually being very frank about just how hard it is. And I think when someone in Leah's piece said, you know, like on a typical day, I'll take a meeting with a producer, but then I may not be able to afford food. And so that's all the little stresses that interfere with me, you know, doing my art.
Yeah.
And so I think we're in a really interesting time right now where people don't think it's a secret, shameful thing they have to carry themselves. Like they feel like they can talk about it.
Right.
Which is important because, as many of my sources said, like the reason they wanted to talk to me in the first place was, won't change. Producers won't know if we don't tell them.
Right. Right. There's some generalizations can be made. I tried to make in my editor's note the point that while market forces determine, and unions, to the extent that they have power still, in the determine wages and compensation and deals that you could make that can be made in the for-profit commercial sphere, in the nonprofit world, those factors have an undeniable influence because we all live in the same economy and are competing in many ways with the for-profit institutions and for for-profit jobs. And in nonprofits, everything is, I beat this drum all the time, everything is about what you can raise and mission. There's revenue streams, but none of those are for profit. They're all to go back into the mission. And so there is a reservoir of goodwill that can be, you know, not depended on, but that can be tapped if it's done in a sort of collegial way. Like, I don't think that anyone goes into the nonprofit theater to exploit people, right? Or to exploit themselves or to let themselves be exploited. And if we can just talk frankly with each other and go, you know, look at how many opportunities we can create and how well they can be compensated, or what kind of deal can be reached among artists so that artists aren't, you know, exploiting themselves or letting themselves be exploited or breaking their backs. But it's not like it's, I think what can be helpful, because it is a management and labor, it definitely is management and labor, but it's not like giant corporations, soulless, and you know, even those forces aren't necessarily, don't rely on people's malice to exploit people. There's forces and systems that are in place, and they need to be nudged and pushed and advocated for and against to get them to work, you know, equitably. So it's a good topic to bring up.
Yeah, no, it's super fascinating. I mean, I didn't work a ton on the issue, but I am a fellow fan of the compensation conversation, like deep. I think we talked a lot about when we were putting the issue together. One of my favorite features on a different website, Refinery29, their money diaries, which is similar to what we did with Artist Conversation, where they give a week in the life of, it's mostly young women on Refinery29 and just how they kind of pay for their life all around the world. And it's fascinating to see how people spend their money. I feel like people never want to talk about being on a budget and never want to talk about being on a diet. Those are kind of two taboo topics. And I feel like we're kind of reaching age where it's like, you know what? It's okay to talk about, I don't eat gluten. And it's okay to talk about, hey, I can't spend money on this because I don't make that money. So
Right. We're
kind of like getting rid of those taboos. But I also think it's an important conversation in the fact that, you know, artists don't get paid enough and how do they put their money together? So it's kind of a perfect marriage of those two ideas.
Yeah. Right. Well, it was also because I've talked to multiple sources, and one source in particular was one of the leaders of Fair Wage on Stage, which was this actress advocacy group that basically amplified the message that off-Broadway actors aren't making enough to live in New York City, and some of those members were part of the equity negotiation team that, you know, eventually helped negotiate for a much higher equity off-Broadway contract. And this person, his name's Adam Green. He listens to the podcast. Hi, Adam. He was telling me about, like, when they were doing these videos, these testimony videos, they were very intent on emphasizing that they're not demonizing producers. Mm. They know, like, it's really hard to fundraise for a theater. It's really hard to make theater.
Right.
And like, and opera and theater is just so important and it's what they love doing. But at the same time, this is the realities of it. And, you know, both things can be true simultaneously.
Right.
The art can be amazing, but at the same time, like, it shouldn't supersede someone else's ability to feed themselves.
So they're actual Fair Wage activists. Some of them were on the team, negotiating team. Okay, I thought they were just outside agitating group or whatever.
Yeah.
I should add that we roped in a story that was written a couple of months ago about Artist Repertory Theater in Portland, Oregon, which joined the League of Resident Theaters, LORT. Made an effort to join over a number of years, and one of their main reasons was that they wanted to pay artists better, so they're and to keep artists in Portland and sustain them. So
right.
I mean, that's just a good example of a theater making it part of their mission, you know, the way that the theater might make low ticket prices their mission, or diversity making their mission compensating artists. I think that without that kind of will in the mission, it's hard to the market forces are just going to drive it down and down, because there's so many, you know, right, the supply and demand is sort of whack.
Right, and if you don't ask for it, they won't give it to you. And I think I should clarify for listeners that, like, equity union minimums are set at what they are, and producers can pay more than union minimums, but from my sources, most of the time they opt not to, unless you negotiate for it directly.
It's much more it's much more common on Broadway for people to make more than the minimum, but off Broadway it's not, right?
Yes, that's true. Yeah, so like, stars can negotiate for more on Broadway. That's why Al Pacino made what was it, like,
I don't know exactly what he made.
Shitload.
I know Vanessa Hudgens made somewhere in $30,000-$50,000 a week for when she was in TG, something like that. I don't know the exact number, but yeah, that's about a star salary on Broadway, 30-50K a week.
Yeah, but I learned that actually off Broadway, everyone makes the same, no matter what role they play.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's hard to negotiate higher off Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
It's also hard to negotiate higher for the nonprofits. Like, I know stars, even big celebrities, do like roundabout shows. I think they make the minimum.
Yeah. They do, yeah. I think it's within the contract that everyone has to make the same, no matter what. So.
So, I mean, it.
Thank you, stars, for taking a lower salary to do art.
I mean, that does go to the fact that if you are working in a nonprofit setting, you too are not getting a profit. You know, you too are not in it for the profit.
Well, it should be noted that a nonprofit salary on Broadway is a living wage. It's not.
Yeah. No. Exactly.
Yeah.
It should be.
It's not exorbitant.
It should
be. It's not exorbitant like a movie star would be used to, but it's a living wage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it might not be what they're used to.
That's what I said. Yeah. It's not a movie, making a movie salary.
No one's making like $10 million.
Right.
No one's really making, as far as just actors on Broadway, I don't think are making millions of dollars.
No, I don't think
not
so.
Not necessarily,
either.
Unless they're in Hamilton.
Well,
and they work harder, too.
Unless you get a piece of the back end, you don't.
Yeah,
you know.
I think the only person really making millions are the Hamilton producers and Lynn.
Yeah. Right.
And anyone who has a piece of the back end of Hamilton.
Probably Lynn, highest paid Broadway actor. Right now, probably.
Yeah, but
Lin-Manuel's not even an actor right
but
now.
But part of his income from Hamilton is as a writer. So,
yeah, that's
And that's
true,
probably
too.
The most
That's
of
probably
income.
More.
Yeah.
But I mean,
true,
what was radical
true.
About that deal, not just to allude to it, to subtweet it here, is that like the original cast got a piece of the authorship royalties, right?
Yeah.
That's the point.
They got a piece of the growth until the end, I think. I think they all share 1%.
Because they were until considered to be.
Until the end of life.
Yeah.
The end of time.
The end.
Until the end of Hamilton. Anytime Hamilton gets royalties.
Until the heat death of the
Everyone
the
that has a piece of it gets it. Touring, licensing, Mm-hmm. All that goes to people that have it. So basically, set for life.
Yeah.
Because they were in the room where it happened. Anyway, you mentioned how we don't have arts funding here. We do have a little bit still until now to segue to our other topic.
It's all money all the time today.
I should just mention that there was a story in the online publication called The Hill. I think it's just online, The Hill.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a fairly reliable publication. But they reported a story in which they said they had learned or seen plans for a budget that was being looked at by the Trump transition team that detailed plans to privatize the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, zero out the NEA, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the National Endowment for the Humanities, among other things. Actually, there was a lot about how this cutting a bunch of other things, which...
privatize PBS,
that's
right? And NPR.
Right, but those are actually, as many people pointed out, a small part of the budget. It was something that in 10 years would cut $10 trillion in the budget, but there were a bunch of, like the Department of Commerce was going to be cut. There were a bunch of other things that were cut that we didn't pay attention to because we were interested in the arts part of it. And it was immediately picked up as, and purported as, Trump plans to cut the NEA. It's like, well, I think people need to talk themselves back from the cliff for a second.
And then we responded.
I would say on social media, because we have some sources close to the NEA, let's say, who were saying that, for one thing, maybe they wouldn't be the best ones to know about this, but they knew nothing about this. And this is not generally the way that it works.
Mm-hmm.
That budgets like this have been proposed since the 80s and have never gotten traction. They got some traction in the 90s because of NEA wars being politicized. But even this Hill article pointed out that this particular faction of the right, which based at the Heritage Foundation mainly, comes up with budget blueprints like this all the time, and they haven't even had success with a GOP House in the last, even I think under the Bush administration, or maybe
Reagan too. Right?
Well, some of those go back, but even more recent examples where you have a GOP controlled House did not approve this very draconian budget. So I think, I heard a lot of interpretation about how we should take seriously this as a right-wing strategy, and all bets are off with the new administration, especially this one. You don't know what the heck's going to happen. Maybe things that were completely off the table are now on the table. So it's important to take it seriously. I agree. It's also maybe semi-cynically, like maybe this is a good way to get us to worried about it and rallying to it, like we need to fight for it. But
call your people.
Right,
call
exactly.
Your Congress people.
I don't think, however, it's either a definite thing and should report like the NEA is going away, or B, the top of our list as citizens that we need to worry about at the moment. I would just say anecdotally also, just finally, I'll just close. I don't think that the NEA and arts funding is the political football it used to be. You hear a lot of stuff about, very backwards attitudes on certain political sides, but arts funding and the value that arts has for communities is pretty well established. And it's arts, given that arts funding is already really low, maybe you could arguably scandalously low, and it's a lot less than it should be. Given that as the given circumstances, the support for it is pretty solid, and it's not a strict partisan thing like the right is against it, the left is for it. There's actually a lot more variation.
Well, it's bipartisan.
Well, it's bipartisan. Yeah. I mean, anecdotally, there are some folks who feel that some Democrats are not as supportive of the arts as they could be, and there's a lot of Republicans who are quite supportive of the arts in their districts. So it doesn't break down along the typical lines. We'll certainly be reporting on it to see what happens with it. And we have an arts and advocacy or an advocacy wing here at TCG, which keeps us up to date and also helps advocate for it. I think, full disclosure, we should say some NEA funds do come to TCG as well. So we should mention that we are beneficiaries of that. So
if we're not panicked, you probably shouldn't be.
Exactly.
So keep your eye on it.
Definitely keep your eye on it. I mean, I think vigilance is certainly,
we can't say it won't happen because,
I would just say in general, vigilance seems to be, and picking our battles as well seems to be the watchword of the moment with this new administration.
Though I think just anecdotally from seeing my Twitter feed and news feed, I think they're probably going after environment and energy first before they get to us. So we have some time.
And women's health.
Well, and women's health. Well, yeah, so we have some time.
This is where I say as citizens, the NEA is really important. And we should have more arts funding, but, you know, I would say that it's not as citizens, maybe the top of our list. And I also would hate for people just to think of the NEA as a lost cause, because it's not.
No, and I think the reason we haven't reported on it is because it's mostly speculation, and
right,
we don't want people, especially when, you know, a magazine like a magazine that's partially funded by the NEA, to when if we report that, it may be seen as truth, and so
right,
we don't want to get people panicked without reason.
Right.
Now, if it's more definite, then we'll let you know.
People are also already panicked, so I think part of this is to be like, it's okay,
right,
you guys.
I would say that it was really my decision. I'll take full responsibility for putting out the word that this does not seem to be, our sources tell us this is not a true story. We weren't able to report further. I felt bad about that. It seemed like people were kind of confused. Like, what are you saying? Why are you saying this? Why are you contradicting the Washington Post? It's like, well, we're trying to get the word out that this is not a done deal, that this, you know, and that there's, yeah, I mean, we hope I hope that that was a service, and I realized that probably a better service would be to report the full story and just keep our mouth shut, I suppose.
The Washington Post just basically re-reported the Hill story.
Yeah,
exactly.
They took that as sort of a given, with the caveat saying reportedly, and then they looked into, I mean, kind of admirably looked into how this is not going to help the budget at all. I mean, there were good think pieces. Alyssa Rosenberg wrote a good one for Washington Post and other people, how cutting the arts, which is the argument I've heard for my entire adult life, is not going to do anything. You know, all these cuts about, like, we'll cut NPR. I mean, wasn't there something about that under the first Obama administration?
Yeah, and I think someone made the comparison that it's like if you had $100,000 and you're taking out $5.
Right.
It makes no difference.
Didn't someone also say that it costs that amount for a year of security for Trump in New York or something like that? I forget what it is. Anyway.
Yeah, like it.
Yeah, but that money is coming from New York's taxes.
Yeah, yeah. But the equivalent is like, anyway, that, not to be overly political with the numbers, it's just the NEA is such a tiny amount. And I think one of the reasons why I'm not as worried about even protecting the small piece of the pie we had is that it's been pretty well demonstrated and argued that the tiny amount that the NEA does give generates so much other giving and other economic activity, and that it's such a net win, such a small win for such a small investment, a big win for such a small investment that even, I mean, this is the sort of conservative argument or argument that appeals to conservatives and civic minded people all over the country, that funding the arts is good for, you know, the economy.
Right, right.
So,
but maybe in the meantime, don't do something that pisses.
Don't say that, Dave.
Okay, I will cut that out.
Say whatever you want.
But he's a very thin-skinned man, so.
I think, didn't Leia, our writer, do a protest at Trump Tower?
Yes, she did, Leia Winkler. she flashed the Trump Tower.
She flashed the Trump Tower, but tattooed on her back was, you know, do whatever the fuck you want with your art.
Yeah.
Which I think is a message I want to proclaim as well. So do whatever the fuck you want with your art. I will say that. Should we need to do a parental advisory
this
for this show?
This podcast, don't play it in your car if your children are listening. Some adult language was used.
Let's see if iTunes finds that one out.
All right. I always like when I hear this podcast contains explicit language.
I don't even think they do that, and they don't even say that anymore, though. They just have a little E in next to the podcast.
No, they do. They do.
Slate
podcasts I listen to say that. I think a few times they said, unfortunately, this particular one contains no explicit language. Anyway, ours occasionally does. Exciting. So, Susie, you want to set up our interview with Robert Barry Fleming?
Yeah, we have an interview with Robert Barry Fleming, who's a really interesting guy. He was the director of artistic programming at Arena Stage, and I met him when he had that role when he came to the RTCG conference in Cleveland. He's an actor, director, choreographer, arts administrator, really interesting guy. He started at Cleveland in August, I want to say, working with Laura Kepley, who's the artistic director there, and Kevin Moore, the managing director. He's great. He's loving Cleveland. His first project at the theater is going to be directing Between Riverside and Crazy on their main stage. And then he's also currently programming their new play reading festival, which is in May, I believe. I forget the name of it, and they haven't announced the lineup yet, but he says the lineup will be good. And so that's great. There's a lot of good new play work going on in Cleveland, so it's excited to have Robert be a part of that. And so, yeah, he was visiting New York, and we had a chat. So here it is.
Let's listen.
Well, welcome to Off Script. I'm Susie Evans, the senior editor of American Theater, and I'm here today with a very special guest, Robert Barry Fleming, who is the new associate artistic director of Cleveland Playhouse. And I was actually thinking about it today, Robert. We actually met for the first time at Cleveland for the TCG conference in 2015.
That's right. I completely forgot that. That's right.
Yeah. Any seeds planted during that conference?
Absolutely, without question. First of all, Cleveland was not on my radar as vibrant of a city as it actually is. And that conference was really my first clue in that something very different was happening in the Rust Belt, than common mythology might lead one to believe. That was a great conference. I hadn't been to a TCG conference in many years. I got to meet Laura Kepley, who, I work with on leadership, as well as Kevin Moore at Cleveland Playhouse. And I was just so impressed with how they ran the conference, as well as, just their vision for the theater, that even though it was approaching its centennial season and, had this kind of long distinguished history, was clearly being revitalized, like Cleveland itself, through their leadership. So I was so impressed. I had no inkling that there would be a position opening. So I kind of had the luxury of just meeting Laura in that capacity, hitting it off with her instantly, just finding her such a vibrant, smart, great leader and a great artist. And we just had a lot of fun at that conference. It was just a really good time. And when the position opened up, I thought, oh yeah, that would be really exciting to be able to work on that, work with that team, in that city.
Yeah. And I mean, previously you were at Arena Stage in DC as the director of artistic programming.
That's right.
Is your role similar at Cleveland Playhouse?
There is a lot of overlap. I do help head over, I am a part of the season selection. I am also a part of new project generation, new play development. There is some element of scouting and that kind of a thing. Exciting additional part, loved being at Arena and working with Molly. It was wonderful, but Arena did not have a MFA program, kind of collaborative environment, and we at Cleveland Playhouse do have a wonderful partnership with Case Western Reserve University, Cleveland Playhouse MFA acting program, headed by Don Carrier and Ron Wilson. And so getting to teach again was really exciting. Getting to be a staff director, being involved with organizational leadership as well. That trio of responsibility made it a very attractive place to be.
Yeah. Where did you teach before this?
I taught at the Old Globe USD program.
Oh, cool.
Used to teach singing for the graduates there, and did some dialect and vocal coaching, and you know, working just with all the students on various projects and that kind of a thing, and directed in their program as well. And so I enjoyed that work so very much, and found that I missed it, not being able to be in the classroom with the students, have that lab to continue to develop my understanding of great literature, new work, and the craft.
Yeah. Is Cleveland a relatively like new city for you? Are you from anywhere nearby?
Interestingly enough, I have two places in the country where I have family. Uh-huh. All my mother's family is basically in the DC area. All my father's family was basically in Cleveland.
Oh, so my gosh.
I have had many years of grieving the fact that, well, I'm in the entertainment industry. I'll never really work in a city where I have family and be able to hang out. And now in my middle age, I have the great joy of having worked in both cities that I have family and have that kind of connection to be able to do what I love, continue that kind of work and still be around family and not feel like sacrificing that, you know, as many, I think many of us have to do.
Yeah. And I mean, you also have a great career as a director, choreographer, actor. Do you find now, do you gravitate towards one of those roles more than the others? Or
yeah, I think I'm definitely on the other side of the table with the directing, the choreographing. I think much more globally. I think about the work as well as, you know, my part in it. I love acting. I never really think of myself as quitting, but it's just as those interests grow and those opportunities present themselves, it becomes, you know, really attractive to just continue to go down the path that is being laid out before you. And so I feel very much more like a director, choreographer these days, educator and organizational leader than I do an actor. Yeah. It just feels kind of consonant with where I really am in my own growth as an artist and leader.
Yeah. And I mean, the first show you'll direct at Cleveland Playhouse will be Between Riverside and Crazy, right? In April. How did that project come to you on your
plate? It was programmed for the season. There were a couple of projects in the season that, you know, as a staff director, I knew I would be directing something each season. But obviously this was such a, it's such a classic already. Mm-hmm. You know, in the tradition of Arthur Miller's family dramas, you know, it's like what Stephen Atlee Geergis is presenting, these new fractured kind of families of choice, as well as family of blood, is something that was eminently and thoroughly attractive to be a part of interpreting for the Playhouse. And so jumped on the opportunity to be able to do that piece of work.
Yeah, it's a great play. I mean, Pulitzer Prize winner. So.
Absolutely. You can't go wrong with that.
Yeah. It sounds like you have so much on your plate with the MFA and staff directing and working on season planning. Are there any things on your agenda that you really want to get done in the Cleveland Playhouse or things that you're really excited to be working on there?
Yeah, I think the idea of new play development, it's always exciting to interpret classics, but new play development, contributing to the American canon, being a part of that is obviously really attractive, really exciting. And Cleveland Playhouse has a new ground theater festival that is the closest thing to what one might describe as a developmental arm, a place where we do new play readings, new play workshops. We have a centerpiece production. And it's a place that we can bring in artists that we're really excited by, we think are making important contributions to the field, and support them in developing new work over that festival period, and share the work with our community, things that we think are really important to add to the conversation. And the fact that I get to head that up and help program that and shepherd that process and continue our commitment to excellence through that kind of work and really supporting artists is super exciting to us.
Yeah. When is that festival?
That'll be the second and third week of May.
Okay,
that
cool.
We'll be sharing that work with the public.
So you haven't announced what's going to be?
We haven't quite announced. We are really excited about the prospects and the artists that'll be involved. And that'll be coming up real soon.
Yeah. And you worked on a lot of new play development at Arena as well.
I did. I had the great pleasure of working with terrific artists like Tori Hall and Blood Quilt, helping shepherd Dear Evan Hansen in its initial run at Arena. So very exciting to be able to add to that. It's the kind of thing, as a actor, you make a really important contribution to a production, but to be able to shepherd other great artists' work and help them realize what they want to do with that work and make that contribution to the canon is super thrilling, you know?
Yeah. Another thing I feel like that both of us got to experience at the conference was kind of the idea of just the Cleveland theatrical community, which it seems from the news we've been reporting on and reading is kind of going through a bit of some change recently. And Cleveland Playhouse is kind of a big you know, stalwart in the resident theater movement, and it's 100 years old. But how do you kind of see your role and the Playhouse's role and the change and the growth that's happening in the Cleveland theater community?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, as you know, those first theaters in the American Regional Theater movement, like Cleveland Playhouse Arena, you know, they hold a very special place in those communities in terms of continuing to support and shepherd other
artists.
You
only work at the long-held theaters, Arena.
that's my specialty. That's my thing, you know. I consider myself amongst the luckiest of artists that I have gotten to work with such amazing people like Molly Smith, and working now with Laura Kepley and Kevin. And you know, the legacy that the artists who have been through those organizations throughout the years, and the contributions are too many to enumerate in this conversation. But the idea to be a part of what was there first, led the way in having these conversations, these visionaries who have led us to understand what the regional theater movement can really do, and to see the evolution of that. And I think, you know, what you're describing, as Cleveland continues to have its own renaissance and revitalization, there are so many terrific young artists, Nathan Motto over at Obama, other terrific artists and leaders who are making really substantive contributions to the theatrical landscape, and reflecting something that is distinctly of our region, of the greater Cleveland, you know, area. And it all seems to reflect something that is fundamentally American, and, you know, these Rust Belt cities that are revitalizing themselves, like DC, like Cleveland, like Pittsburgh, like Detroit, Philly, you know, they're going through such enormous change. Mm-hmm. And the theaters in those centers, I think, are reflecting some of the excitement of that.
Yeah. And I mean, you're part of the season planning and the season organizing of the theater. And obviously our world is in an interesting place politically in right now. You just left DC, but indeed, what do you kind of see as like the role of art, the role of theater as we enter into a new, I'm not going to use the word era because that seems too long, but a new period of time?
Yeah, I mean, we're living in a pretty remarkable time, something that I don't think any of us really anticipated. And, you know, the regional theater has had its own evolution of identity and understanding of its place in its community and in the national conversation. I think it continues to be a place where not only new work that you might not want to develop in New York per se would have a home to kind of incubate and continue to investigate what these great artists are interested in and curious about, without the critical pressures of opening up directly in New York. I think that's obviously one role, but I think one of the more significant roles is really that avocation for art as something that is other than disposable entertainment. I think, you know, as the NEA began to, and other foundations, the funding started to become more and more limited. And, you know, and that's been in my maturation as an artist, seeing that like the 80s through now. And it's just kind of really a reflection of how art and theater specifically is received. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think we all who work in the regional theater recognize how indispensable and essential the work that all of us do and our contribution. But I think that's not always legible to the public. I think it's easy to think of it as like, well, it's entertainment, and it is indeed. But I think it also has a way of reflecting something about your time and place in a way that no other discipline can do. You know, it's, you don't get the same multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary view of who you are and what time and place you're living in any other discipline than theater. I don't think even the electronic media can do it quite in the same visceral way as a live testimony.
Yeah.
You know, church, it feels like church, you know. Yeah. to be there with other artists, collaborators, and have that immediate kind of live sensation that's different every night. And so the theater work does that. And I also think the educational initiatives in the theater is when you can really synthesize and integrate that work so that it is all of a piece, as opposed to, well, you do art, you do education, but really thinking that they're not really terribly separate, and we're always using theater craft to educate. So it always has a basis in the theatrical discipline and all that that can do in terms of reflecting something about yourself, investigating something about yourself in a really 3D kind of way. It's not just head, it's not just heart, it's having empathy from a really visceral place when you're watching the work and using the craft to investigate any subject matter,
you know? Yeah, that's great. So what's happening right now at Cleveland Playhouse? What can we look forward to? What can people see?
We're starting tech right now for our Ken Ludwig's Baskerville, directed by Brendan Fox. They'll be starting performances this weekend, a really exciting production, one that initiated Arena, and it's thrilling to see a full-bodied interpretation of it in this iteration in life. Ken's work is always a big favorite of our Cleveland audiences. We did Comedy of Tenors last year, and he has a long history with us, so we're thrilled that we're bringing that to our audiences. We'll be moving in next to How I Learned to Drive, directed by Laura Kepley. Obviously, Paula's work, Paula Vogel's work is such a stalwart of what great American drama is, and we're thrilled that we're able to investigate this classic of hers as well. And then Between Riverside and Crazy, as you mentioned, will be coming up right after that. So we've got a really full season. We also have a collaboration with Disney, Freaky Friday.
That's coming to you.
It'll be coming to us after La Jolla and before it heads down to Texas at the Alley. And so we're really excited that we've got Chris Ashley and Sergio's work coming to us on what is a really exciting and thrilling, heartwarming kind of musical that had its initial run at the Signature Theater. So we've had such excitement at the beginning of the season with All the Way and A Christmas Story and Sex with Strangers with Joni Schultz's work and that. So it's a really thrilling season, and just more prep for what we'll be announcing in just a couple of weeks for our 17-18 season.
Yeah, well, we can't wait to see what's coming up next. Was there anything else you wanted to chat about, or?
I just said to Susie, this is the first time I've been in TCG Digs. If you get a chance, you ought to come up here. It is bumping. I love this place.
Yeah. We're not in Cleveland. Robert's actually in New York here. So it's cool. We got good views. If you have a window up here on the 24th floor in Midtown TCG,
come visit. They do good work. They make a big contribution.
Well, thanks so much for coming by, Robert.
Thanks, it's our pleasure to have you here. Great seeing you.
I'm so happy you're in Cleveland, and I feel like I had a small part to do with it. You know,
you did indeed.
Having met you in Cleveland. You probably thought I was there. I'm not, so sorry. I'm just kidding. Anyway, thanks so much for chatting.
Thank you.
And we're back with recommendations of things to talk about, think about, read, see, what you have deep.
I'm going to piggyback on something that Susie said earlier. The story that I wrote about the six people showing me their finances, I kind of stole that idea from Refinery 29, their Money Diary series, which Susie and I are obsessed with, because we don't talk about our finances to anyone because we find it kind of shameful. So it's nice to be amongst like company within the Money Diaries, because not only is it people making six figures in New York City, it's also people making $30,000 a year as a writer, or $40,000 a year as a dancer, or working in arts admin. So it's a variety of women in different cities and their professions. There are some artists in there, as you may have guessed. And it basically shows what their budget is and also what they spend their money on in a given week. So it breaks it down to food, entertainment, you know, expenditures, that kind of, like, if you bought a water at lunch, like, you write that down too.
So it's called Refinery 29. You go to Money Diaries.
Yes.
You can just type all that in, you'll find it.
Yes.
Great.
And we've noticed, Susie and I, that most people save money by not eating, which we do not recommend that you do that. But if you literally want to be a starving artist.
So wait, do they say that in the diary?
They don't say that. It's literally like 7 days, and they each day they're like, at 9 o'clock, I had cereal. At 10 o'clock, I spent money on a coffee. At noon, I bought lunch, or I bought batteries, or I bought a pair of shoes impulsively online. They literally like timestamp every purchase for a week. And the people that don't spend the most money literally don't eat.
Yeah, like sometimes they'll just say, oh, I had hummus and apples for dinner.
Yeah. And they'll be like, I had popcorn. Well, or like, there was free soup in the kitchen.
Is it possible that, you know, is it possible that they bought groceries at one point and then didn't record everything they ingested?
No, they usually tell you everything they eat. It's kind of like a food diary, too.
Oh, okay.
Sometimes they don't buy groceries that week, and I think they usually save the most money.
Do they have a Fitbit reading of what their miles and their heart rate, too?
Split out their spending. It's really interesting. I find that most people don't buy a lot of like shopping things on the Money Diary.
It's all women.
It's all young women. Yeah. Refinery 29 is a online magazine for women, I think, ages like 18 to 45. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So
being a young woman's expensive, right?
Boys can read it too.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Right. If you're interested about other people's finances, this literally is everything these people spend money on.
And then maybe I'll teach you how to budget, because that's what Susie and I started doing after.
It's also really interesting when they do the people that are in relationships, where they talk about like how couples split their finances. Mm. That's really fascinating.
It makes you want to be in a relationship because you save a lot of money.
You
if you live together. Right, Rob? Just kidding.
That's what I've heard.
Don't you live with your wife, Rob?
As long as you don't have children.
Anyway, I think it's Susie's turn.
Yeah.
It's my turn. Okay. I haven't seen a show in a little while, so I'm going to recommend something I haven't seen.
Whoa.
Which I know is not usually kosher, but I've read the play, and as listeners of the podcast know, I'm a big fan of the playwright.
Becca
Brunstetter's The Oregon Trail is making its New York premiere. See? Rob knew. Becca Brunstetter's play, The Oregon Trail, which I believe was developed at the O'Neill Theater Center 3 or 4 years ago, maybe longer, is finally making its New York premiere at Faultline Theater Company. I haven't seen it, but I really want to, and I'm going to go. It's great if you're a 90s kid and played Oregon Trail in your school's computer lab and, you know, died of dysentery on the way to California.
Definitely check out Susie's interview with Becca, which was last summer
spring. Becca's now a writer on the NBC show This Is Us, which is also one of my favorite shows, so you should watch that too.
I believe Oregon Trail was just at Portland Center Stage, right?
Yeah, it's been at other places across the country, but
it had
its
debut
York
in Portland,
now.
Of course.
I don't know if its debut was in Portland. It's had a few productions in L.A. too, I think.
It doesn't look like it was the world premiere, but it's been around the country.
It's been to its home state.
Yeah, but it's in New York. Which I know our listeners are across the country, but I'm in New York and I'm going to see it in New York. So go see it.
I want to recommend two online things. Well, two reading things. One is Theater Times. I think it's theatertimes.org. Theater spelled R-E times. Someone should check. I think it's .org. Anyway, it's a.
I mean, and if they were smart, they do theater E-R. Times too, just to be safe.
In any case, it's a site that aggregates global theater news, and I believe the dramaturg Magda Romanska, I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, is behind it. And I just find we try to keep up our global coverage, but their global coverage, because they're aggregating stuff from all over the world, just runs circles around what we can do. It's fascinating to read about theater all over the world, and we're going to probably be leaning on it heavily for upcoming for ideas and resources for upcoming global columns and our international issue in May, June. The other one is I just want to recommend Jesse Green at New York Magazine. I used to run a site called Stage Grade where I read all the critics around town and aggregated their reviews into sort of a Metacritic kind of thing, and then Ken Davenport bought that and killed the site. That's a whole other story. It's a sad one. You can look up sometime. In any case,
Rob's not bitter at all.
Out of professional interest, but I keep up with who's the critics are and who I like and who I don't like and who I agree with and don't. And I would just say that Jesse Green was always one of my favorite just arts journalists, theater journalists. I mean, if you haven't read his profiles of Arthur Lorentz.
His piece on Spider-Man when it was in tech is amazing. Yeah, Julie
Taymor, Spider-Man. His piece on Tony Kushner from, I forget what the occasion was, but I think it might have just been IHO when it was in. His stuff is just always, it's great profile, but somehow he managed to get so much opinion and perspective into it and yet still have the people talk to him. The Arthur Lorentz one is a masterpiece. Anyway, he was such a great feature writer. But he took over for Scott Brown at New York Magazine a couple years ago, or maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And I didn't warm up to him immediately. But what I found recently is that I guess I'm a bit of a curmudgeon and I don't immediately love all the things that everyone else is loving. And
you
I don't
guess.
Wanna, I think that's what happens when you get older.
Yeah. I don't think it's just old.
I think that's what happens when you see too much theater.
I was always this way though. No, I think, anything that's good, this happens with film too, anything that's even sort of good gets overpraised, in my opinion. And
like La La Land?
Shut your mouth.
Yes, like, definitely like La La Land. I would say Moonlight's been overpraised too, frankly. It's great, but it's also been overpraised. But I find him to be a refuge for me. He seems to be sometimes the only person who will, without trashing works that have been overpraised, bringing them down a little bit and saying, hey, is this not really the greatest thing ever? So it just in a general, like, he was one of the only critics who questioned the brilliance of Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet, which I, you know, also did not think was a total home run. He was one of the only ones who
excuse me, Rob, when I was reviewing theater at Backstage Magazine, I reviewed it at Ars Nova and did not rave about it.
Well, thank you.
I don't remember that.
No, but I mean, but the current run, everyone seems to think the current run is much better.
Is
a triumph, and I don't agree. But
I don't agree either.
Well, there you go. But
yay.
I like it the best of all three.
He's the critic. If you have misgivings about a show that everyone else loves, go to Jesse Green. The other, I'll just mention the other shows. I think Sweat was overrated. I think Sweat is a solid play, but it's got, I don't think it's a great play. I think it's not Lynn's best. Anyway, this is just my opinion. And the most recent one, I'm going to, you know, heresy as well. Jitney, I feel like was overpraised. August Wilson is always worth seeing. This is not one of his best plays. And I feel like the praise it's getting, if it gets people in the door, I'm all for it. But it's worth calling out the ways that play is not great. And this production's pretty great.
Newcomer August Wilson has an Oscar nomination.
Right. Is this his first, I guess?
I think it's his first.
All right. Yeah. There were a lot of theater people getting Kenneth Lonergan,
Viola
Terrell,
Davis,
Lin-Manuel Miranda, Pasek and Paul.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So I'm all for that, I suppose. Anyway, I would just say Jesse Green. And again, he's not taking these things down. He's just like, he's giving them a more, he's looking at them from other angles and not just raving crazily about,
he's throwing cold water in your face.
I will say that none of these are pans. He writes beautifully as well. So anyway, Jesse Green, read his stuff, especially if you want to, you know, if you want your views about something you love challenged, or if you feel like, God, did nobody else see the flaws in this great thing that everyone else thinks is great? Go to Jesse. Also, I hope he has time to write his profiles again, because he told me recently he doesn't have time to do them because he's reviewing. It's like, well, come on.
Oh, he's such a good features writer. He needs to write
I know.
More
he was a
those.
Great features writer.
Keep doing it.
Hashtag journalist problems.
Hashtag employed arts journalist problems.
Mm-hmm. Can't complain too much.
Good point.
And on that note, rate us on iTunes. And also, I finally stopped being lazy and put us on Google Play and Stitcher. So please tell your friends who have Android and whatever that phone is that Google has. What's a Google phone?
That sounds right. Google phone.
Google phone.
The Google phone. Thanks for listening.
So you can find us on multiple platforms, and please review us. Thanks, guys. See you next time.
Bye.